It is now time for our panel discussion, and it's my honor and pleasure to introduce the moderator for today's panel discussion, Mort Downey. Mort Downey served as the Deputy Secretary of Transportation for the Clinton administration under Secretary Rodney Slater, and he also previously had served as the Assistant Secretary of Transportation during the Carter administration. And I consider Mort one of the most knowledgeable persons about all facets of transportation. In 2008, he led the Obama Transition Agency Review Team for Transportation. Now, Mr. Downey currently operates his own transportation consultancy, working on a wide variety of institutional, financial, and organizational issues for public and private clients, both foreign and domestic. Since 2010, Mort has also served as vice chair of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority Board. He holds a bachelor's degree from Yale University in political science and a master's degree in public administration from New York University. He has also completed his advanced management program at Harvard University. So please welcome my very good friend, Mort Downey. Mort?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and it's always a pleasure to be with you today and at our Mineta Institute board meeting tomorrow. We heard from Catherine Thompson this morning that all the options are on the table with respect to how to pay for our transportation systems. We've heard the same message from both sides of Capitol Hill. And the other thing we heard from Chief Counsel Thompson was it's time for a dialogue about what those options should be. So let's kick off that dialogue this morning with a panel we have of transportation experts. We have viewpoints from the national level, the state level, the regional level. We want to explore those possible solutions, what some of the revenue options might be, and how they will be received, both from citizens and from legislators. And I think I have a feeling the reception may be different in both in those two audiences. And we also have from Dr. Agrawal a newly completed national survey. So it'll be one of our up-to-date insights into what the public is thinking. As in the first session, we will want to get your written questions, and they'll be picked up from you. Come up here, and I will sort them out and allocate those questions to one or more of our panelists. Let me introduce our panelists now. We'll hear from each of them, and then we will proceed to the questions and answers. Going from my left, Dr. Asha Weinstein Agrawal is director of the Mineta Transportation Institute's National Transportation Finance Center and is also an associate professor in the Urban and Regional Planning Department at San Jose State. She's worked in transportation finance for more than 10 years. Other research interests that she has include transportation planning and policy, planning for pedestrians and cyclists, so if you have questions on those modes, direct them to Asha, and transportation history. Secretary Manette and I will be happy to talk to you about that, having been a part of it for a long time. Dr. Agrawal holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard University, a Master of Science from the London School of Economics, and a PhD from University of California, Berkeley. Next to Asha, and we'll call on each of them after we've introduced them, Flora Castillo is the current 2012 to 2013 chair of the American Public Transportation Association, known as APTA, and we thank APTA for their co-sponsorship of this session. Flora is APTA's first Latina chair, and APTA, if you're not familiar with it, is a nonprofit international association of more than 1,500 members, including transit agencies, transit professionals, businesses, and the like. Since 1999, Flora has also been a member of the New Jersey Transit Board of Directors, and that's a very progressive agency that's doing a lot in transit, and a lot of what they're doing is because FLORA pushes them to do it, ensuring quality service for customers, increased seating capacity. I assume that means more seats, not bigger seats, right? Cleaner trains and buses, and purchase of new equipment. Born and raised in El Salvador, Ms. Castillo immigrated to Long Island, New York, in 1981 and received her bachelor's degree in public administration from Long Island University. Malcolm Dougherty, whom I'm sure many in this room know, is director of the California Department of Transportation, we all know as Caltrans, where he leads the $11 billion organization and the department's 20,000 employees, they're all behind him, building, maintaining, and operating the 50,000 lane miles of California's transportation system. Malcolm is also a member of California's Toll Bridge Program Oversight Committee, providing project oversight on the seismic retrofit of the state's toll bridges, including the iconic $6+ billion San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. And during his 20 years with Caltrans, Mr. Dougherty has served as chief deputy director and as district director in the Fresno area. He holds a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Rutgers University. And our last panelist is Jeff Morales, again, I think familiar to everyone here, chief executive officer of the California High-Speed Rail Authority, coming to that job based on a distinguished record of experience managing large and complex transportation issues and transportation projects. Jeff is formerly Caltrans director, more recently served as, along with me, as officer in Parsons Brinckerhoff, where he worked with transportation agencies across the United States and internationally to develop and implement major capital programs. He's also a past executive vice president of Chicago Transit Authority, spearheading major reforms at the nation's second largest transit agency. I always have to say that, having been the head of the first largest. Jeff's experience at the...
I will always defer to you.
Yes, right. At the federal level, Jeff's experience includes serving as part of our transition team for the Obama administration, also in prior years during the Clinton administration with the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security, and with other activities within the U.S. Department of Transportation. Let's welcome all of our expert panelists. Let me start by asking each of you to provide your perspectives on the issue of where will we find those revenues that are needed to both protect our existing infrastructure and expand our future transportation systems to meet the needs of a growing population and growing economies in America. We never should forget that this is one of the few industrialized countries in the world that is still growing rapidly, continues to grow rapidly, and will continue to have increasing needs. We'll first hear from Dr. Agrawal of the Mineta Institute, and we hope you will share the Institute's latest research regarding how the public accepts transportation taxes and fees. Asha?
Thank you very much for the introduction, and also to the Commonwealth Club for organizing today's event and inviting us all to speak with you today. I am very pleased to be here today, as you've just heard, to share the results of a brand new public opinion poll funded by the Mineta Transportation Institute that's looking at public support. So we've heard a lot about perhaps what our elected officials think. What do people, average American residents, think about national gasoline and mileage tax options, as well as public support for some different matters related to funding public transit specifically? This poll is the fourth in an annual series about these issues, and thus, as I said, this is our first really public formal introduction of our survey results. I'd like, by the way, to also acknowledge my co-author on the project, who's here with us today, Professor Hillary Nixon. Now, it seems to be conventional wisdom, as at least we've heard a little bit today, that people hate taxes, and including the tax that we have traditionally used to fund the great majority of our transportation expenses in the U.S., the gas tax. We can read in the newspapers from across the country about how people hate the gas tax, and we can hear speakers at today's events talk about how there's very little enthusiasm among our elected officials for raising it. But does the public truly hate the gas tax as much as everybody seems to imply? The truth is always, of course, tricky to pin down, especially when it comes to something as kind of amorphous and potentially shifting as public opinion. But I would suggest that the picture is not nearly as bleak as conventional wisdom might hold. Politicians seem to hate the gas tax, but I'm not sure that the public is quite as opposed. And so let me tell you why now. I think that's true. So what I'm reporting today is the results of a national survey, a random digit dial phone survey. So it's one of those annoying things where someone bothers you at dinner. And now we're not only able to bother you on your landline, but on your cell phone as well. So we harassed a very generous 1,501 people who responded to our survey. And by the way, we did do the survey both in English and Spanish. Now, I want to stress before I start giving you some specific numbers that the results of this survey are not really going to be a good guide to predicting the support for any specific gas or mileage tax proposal, because people's opinions really vary enormously depending on when you ask and where you ask and what the exact tax is. But what our survey was designed to do, and what I think it actually does very effectively, is show you the relative support we might get if we frame the same kind of tax in different ways. And so let me start now to tell you a bit of what we found. So first we asked people about just the plainest, most generic versions you can imagine of either a federal gas tax increase or a brand new federal mileage tax. And we told people these monies would just be spent for generically transportation purposes with no other information at all. Well, when we asked people about increasing the federal gas tax by 10 cents a gallon to pay for transportation and didn't tell them anything else, we got very low support. Only 23% of our respondents said that they would support that proposal. When we asked them about a brand new flat rate mileage tax, so a penny per mile, this was even less popular, with only 19% of people saying that they would support this concept. But these very low numbers are not the whole story. We discovered that every variation we asked on these tax options, and most of those focused on different gas tax options, had higher support levels, in most cases, much higher support. For example, we asked about what I will call a green mileage tax. So here we told people that the average rate would be a penny a mile, but that the specific rate each vehicle owner paid would vary according to the vehicle's pollution level. And when we asked about that, the support for this green mileage tax was 39%. That's compared to the 19% who would support just the plain penny a mile for everybody. So we're getting a 20 percentage point increase in support just by switching from the flat rate mileage tax to what I'm calling this green version of it. And a similar pattern holds when we looked at all the different variations we asked about with the gas tax. For example, we asked about a 10-cent gas tax increase that would be spread over 5 years, so 2 cents a year increase. Well, when we did that, support went up to 42%. That's a 19 percentage point increase in support compared to the 23% who said they would support just a plain old 10-cent, you know, one-time gas tax increase. To give you another example, this will be my last here, when we asked about a 10-cent gas tax increase all at one time, but said that this time we would dedicate the revenues to improving maintenance of streets, roads, and highways, we got 67% of people saying that they would support that tax increase. That's a supermajority of American residents saying that they would support increasing the gas tax, in this case specifically for maintenance purposes. And not only is that a supermajority, but I would point out that's 44 percentage points more support than we got for just the plain old 10-cent same tax increase, same amount, but for transportation purposes in general with no other information given. Now, let me also mention that a key aim of this multi-year survey project has been to track public opinion over time. So we've asked essentially the same questions now for four different annual surveys. And comparing this year's results with the last 3 years' surveys, the message is extremely simple, clear, easy for me to report. Support for the taxes has changed very little over the four annual surveys. And I think this is a very important finding for two reasons. First, I think it's showing that these findings are real and deep opinions within the American public. We're not, first of all, you can say our survey is not somehow getting a very peculiar 1,500 people that don't really represent the full country. But I think more importantly, this seems to be a topic about which people hold probably fairly solid opinions that aren't changing, you know, every few months. They seem to be kind of deep opinions given how little variation we've seen from year to year. So now let me turn in the few minutes I have remaining to share a few of our survey results that are specifically related to public transit, because that was a core focus of the survey. One finding we have is that when we asked people if they thought improving transit should be an important priority statewide, 80% of people said it should be a priority, a government priority. So clearly there's deep support for public transit service. We also asked people a series of questions to try and understand what they know about how transit's costs are paid for. And the first thing we did here was we asked people if they thought that transit fares cover the full cost of providing transit service. Only 55% of people correctly said no. So that means that the other 45%, and they were varied between the people who said yes, very optimistically, and then a fairly large chunk of people who just said, well, I don't know. And we had some other questions to try and find out if people knew if the local, federal, and state governments all contributed to the cost of providing transit service. And roughly half of our full survey respondents were aware of each level of government's contribution, with knowledge of the federal contribution actually being slightly lower than the other two government entities. Finally, we also asked a set of questions to understand a little bit more about whether people would support different ways of identifying new national revenues to support transit. And one very important finding from this series of questions was that 64% of people, so essentially two-thirds, support using current federal gas tax revenues to pay for public transit as well as, of course, to pay for roads and highways. So there seems to be clear, solid support for using these gas tax revenues for transit and roads and highways. So to sum up, I would argue that the survey results suggest that transportation tax increases, we tested mostly the gas tax, can be acceptable to the public, but under certain circumstances. Support for gas and mileage taxes is going to be significantly increased depending on the sort of care that's put into designing a program that will be acceptable to people. And one thing that really seems to sway public opinion is how you spend the money. Not surprising. So if it's just sort of amorphously for transportation, you may not get very high support. But if you can identify priorities that really speak to the public that they care about, support goes up remarkably. And just as a reminder, in the case of maintenance, we saw a 44 percentage point increase in support, up to 67% of people. And three purposes that seem to be very popular with the public are maintenance, but also safety, and then we tested different environmental protection benefits, and those all really spoke to people and increased support substantially as well. I should just end by mentioning that our report is going to be up on the web on Monday, I believe, with dozens and dozens of tables and numbers and more details for those of you who are interested. And, of course, if you have questions later on, please do get in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Asha, for continuing this effort. And each year we see some stable results and sometimes some improved options. So it's a big contribution. Flora Castillo, let me ask you to share your perspective on what some of the options are to improve our public transit system, which we all know will take money to improve it. Are there going to be ways to find that money?
Great. Thank you, Moore, and thank you for the opportunity to be here and to ride for your ascending leadership with the Mineta Institute. You know, he has been a former past chair of APTA. I'm delighted to be here. My remarks will quickly frame the current state of federal funding for public transit, and I'll summarize some of the innovative financing arrangements. Public transportation is an economic engine. As a $57 billion industry, it directly employs 400,000 people and indirectly supports another 1.9 million jobs in its extensive supply chain. Every $1 billion invested in public transportation creates or supports 36,000 jobs. Every dollar invested in public transit generates $4 in economic return. That's a return of investment of 300%. Our federal elected leaders should be investing more in public transportation, not less. What does the federal investment in public transit's capital projects, its infrastructure look like? The federal government funds 41% of public transit's capital projects, states funded at 14%, local governments another 12%, and 33% is directly generated by public transit systems through revenue-generating activities. Public transit largely operates through partnerships among federal, state, and local governments and the private sector. MAP 21, as you heard earlier, is a two-year law that authorizes federal public transit and highway programs. It's in place until September 2014. It authorized $10.6 billion for public transit for this fiscal year. That's a slight increase of $120 million over the last fiscal year. It also authorizes $10.7 billion for the next fiscal year, 2014, another slight increase. MAP 21 represents the high water mark for federal support. It was enacted when Congress was reluctant to pass any spending bills. So that is a positive step, one that APTA appreciates as a foundation we can build on to secure the resources we need. But MAP 21 does not substantially increase the federal investment in public transportation. The federal transportation program is largely funded by the Highway Trust Fund, which generates money for the transportation overall via a 18.4-cent gas tax that you've heard earlier. Of that 18.4-cent, public transit receives 2.86 cents. The good news, the Trust Fund provides some predictability for public transit funding. But the not-so-good news is that the fund is spending more money than is taken in. This is true across all modes in all types of transportation infrastructure. General fund expenditures have kept the fund afloat. Our year of reckoning, though, is 2015, when the mass transit portion of the fund is expected to be $3 billion in the red, and the highway account will be $6 billion in the red. Increasing the gas tax is one of several approaches, as we've heard, for raising the revenue we need. Other options are on the table, such as fees, surcharges, and leases. But even if we narrow the gap in the trust fund with these other options, it will not be enough to keep infrastructure current or to meet the rising demand. MAP 21 provided for only modest growth after years of essentially flat funding. The U.S. Department of Transportation estimates that we need to make one-time investment of $78 billion, to bring public transit infrastructure up to a state of good repair. That would take care of our present needs, but what about our future? Research says that capital investments from all sources, federal, state, and local, should double if we are to continue to prepare for the rising ridership demands, increases we know they're coming. And consider this. High-speed and intercity passenger rail are coming to America, and some of our colleagues here on the panel will discuss this. But it must be part of a national discussion on our long-term transportation needs. Let's move on to state and local investments. Several state lawmakers have recently made significant steps in responding to the call for more public transportation. Virginia, Maryland, and Colorado have already passed funding legislation this year, as you heard earlier. Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Missouri, Minnesota, and Washington State all have or have had major bills under consideration. There is a lesson here that there's no single model, no one-size-fits-all. Rather, the funding plan that works best is the one that gets enough votes to pass. Across the country, Americans are voting for tax increases to support public transit. Over the past 14 years, more than 73% of transit ballot measures were approved. In 2012, voters around the country approved 49 of 62 transit ballot measures. That's 79%. I have a more recent evidence, too, according to what you've heard from the survey that Asha did. We've heard that more Americans are comfortable and there's a national appetite for paying for public transportation. 74% of taxpayers support the use of their taxes to strengthen public transportation in their own communities. That is an increase of 5% higher than last year. And as our APTA President Michael Milanovi said, that is a landslide. Our fellow citizens may be divided on many issues, but investing in public transit isn't one of them. Now let's turn to investing. Many successful transit projects include both government funding and innovative private financing. Public transit systems are increasingly speaking the public-private language and making the business case for investing in public transit. I'd like to briefly mention five strategies and offer examples that illustrate how they are working. You heard from Katie earlier about the TIFIA program, public-private partnerships, real estate development, toll roads, naming rights. I won't go into details on the TIFIA program, just to say that right now it has created some great opportunities for many investments out there. What about P3s? An example I'd like to share with you is on the Denver Eagle P3, which is a landmark initiative that is attracting greater involvement from the private sector and encouraging the private sector to assume more of the risk. The private consortium managing the project is doing so as a design, build, finance, operate, and maintain turnkey project. The project funding in the amount of $2.1 billion comes from a combination of federal and private sources. It is important to note that the project is based on a local sales tax election, which provided a long-term dedicated revenue stream. Real estate powered the Barclays Center project within the New York City's MTA. The developer and the financial partners have invested billions in acquiring the New Jersey Nets and NBA basketball team and relocating them to Brooklyn. However, the developer is not interested in NBA or basketball. He sees the financial potential of a major development around the new arena located atop the MTA rail lines, which provides access to the entire New York region. This is the story of public transit's market power and demonstrates a high-value relationship between real estate and public transit. This was also the finding in a March 2013 study from APTA and the National Real Estate Association that concluded that real estate located near public transportation is valued at significantly higher levels than similar properties not located near transportation. Finally, a quick point about naming rights. Large public transit systems have become much more aggressive in this area. Philadelphia SEPTA's AT&T station and the Chicago Transit Authority's Apple station are just two examples. And in SEPTA's case, the system not only received funds from AT&T, it also secured station improvements from the company. My larger point here is that there are many ways to finance major projects. Provided we have sufficient, stable, secure federal funds that serve as a magnet for other investments. As I wrap up, I'd like to cite one more statistic. By 2050, the U.S. population is expected to grow by 100 million people. If we're going to sustain a growth economy and meet the transportation needs of our expanding population, we must work with Congress to develop a bill that provides a reliable, multi-year funding stream for public transportation infrastructure now. APTA welcomes your partnership in this critically important endeavor, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much, Flora. Now we'll hear from Malcolm Doherty of Caltrans. Malcolm, you work a lot with the transportation leaders in this region and in the state. Based on that, those relationships, what do you think are the best prospects for transportation revenue short and medium term?
Well, I guess I'm the only panel member that gets let off with a question. Thank you, Mark. Thank you to Mineta Transportation Institute as well as Rod for the great work that they do. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, talk a little bit about the perspective from the state of California side. And I also will put a shout out. Catherine Thompson from USDOT talked about Ray LaHood. We had a very good run in working with USDOT, Ray LaHood, and I thank him for his service to transportation, and we also look forward to working with the new secretary, Secretary Fox. Another thing is we also have a great working relationship in the state of California with our Federal Highway Administration counterparts, one of the best working relationships across the country, and it's as good as it's been in a long time, and that's a Federal Highway Administration is a very important partner, funding partner, as well as protocol for getting projects delivered. So I look to the opportunity to share with you a little bit of perspective on transportation funding. Obviously, I don't think that there's going to be much contradictory in my comments from previous ones, but I also want to give a perspective of where we are at as well as what conversations are ongoing. When I look at transportation funding, I see three primary challenges that exist, and some of these are very parallel with the earlier comments. We have a long-standing gap between the investment needs that are required of the entire transportation system, not just the highways and bridges, but the entire network. And there's a huge gap between those needs and the funding that is available. It's been mentioned several times that there hasn't been any significant adjustment on the state or the federal side to revenue going to transportation in over 20 years since the early 90s. To put it into scale, the California Transportation Commission conducted a needs assessment of all the transportation needs in the state of California. And again, this was a broad-reaching request for state needs, for port needs, for local streets and roads, for transit needs. And the number that was identified was $300 billion worth of needs over the upcoming 10 years. Now, I don't know what you do with that number. That number sucks the air out of the room because it's just not manageable. And if you divide it out, it's $30 billion a year for the next 10 years. And again, it's a difficult number to manage. But I think what we do need to do is break that number down. We need to prioritize what the needs are and then look and align potential revenue sources for the different needs across that broad spectrum. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. Another funding challenge is the growing demand on the transportation system. So we have not made an adjustment to revenues in over 20 years, and we have a growing demand on the existing transportation system. We're asking more of our transportation system than we ever have before. We have more vehicle miles traveled. We have more freight that we are trying to move, and we have more riders in public transportation than we ever have before. Let me put some of the challenges in the state of California in context. We have 10% of all the vehicle miles traveled in the United States in the state of California. We also have the first, the second, and the fourth busiest ports in the United States in the state of California. We move 40% of all the container freight that comes into the United States through California. Another tidbit is we manage three intercity rail corridors, and a little-known fact, those three intercity rail corridors managed by Amtrak are three of the top five busiest rail corridors in the country. And on top of that, the infrastructure is aging, not just the highway and bridges, but the entire transportation network is an aging infrastructure, and we're battling that. And also what was talked about is another challenge. The third challenge that I'll point out is the declining revenues. So we haven't made any adjustments to them. The buying power is decreasing. And we also have this challenge of that cash cow is potentially shrinking with the CAFE standards and the increased fuel economy that is being introduced into the traveling public. Now, those are all for the right the right reasons, less dependency on petroleum and increased air quality and those types of things. But that's the revenue source that we rely on to take care of our transportation system, not only the state highway system, but also many of the transit systems that are out there as well. So we have to look towards all the different alternatives. There's been a lot of conversation about raising the gas tax, but that may not be our long-term solution when in 20 years from now, 25 years from now, which is not that long from today, cars are averaging over 50 miles to the gallon. So what is California doing? We're trying to help ourselves, that's for sure. Back in 2006, we passed Proposition 1B, which invested $19 billion into the infrastructure, much of that going to transportation. Corridor mobility improvement, as well as goods movement and trade corridor improvements. And much of that program had to be delivered to construction by the end of 2012. And not only were those programs almost entirely delivered by the end of 2012, by the competitive market, we were able to actually over-deliver those programs that were committed to the public back in 2006, 2007. We find ourselves in an interesting spot because we talk about the challenges of available revenue, but with Proposition 1B, we also find ourselves with as much workload out in construction as we've ever had before. We currently have 700 projects out in construction valued at $12 billion, and that is directly attributed to Proposition 1B. The ARRA program from the federal stimulus program certainly did not hurt, but again, those are one-time injections into transportation investment. We are very heavily dependent on local sales tax measures, and this is another way that the state of California is helping itself. I think nearly 90% of the state's population lives in a county that is represented by a self-help sales tax. And the contribution to the state highway system from those local sales tax measures is nearly half the investment that is going into the state highway system. And it is local control, local selection of projects, and it is very important. And we're aggressive. A third area where California is helping itself is we are aggressively seeking efficiencies at every turn. The department itself is going through a process of evaluating its processes and its organization to try to streamline and make it as effective as possible. We are looking at every opportunity to partner with those local agencies. We have gotten very sophisticated in how we partner funds, and now we are getting more sophisticated in how we partner to deliver projects. Some of those opportunities are using innovative delivery methods such as design-build, construction management, general contractors, and public-private partnerships. These are not dominating the landscape. Our only public-private partnership that is in the field today is actually in the Bay Area, the Doyle Drive Replacement Project. And out of those 700 projects that we have in construction, we have about 10 design-build projects. But there is an opportunity there to deliver projects more efficiently, and I think that that's one other area that we are looking at. Statewide, we are having a conversation. The governor, last year when he introduced his budget, as well as when he did the State of the State, he called upon the secretary, the acting secretary for business and transportation and housing, to form a work group called the California Transportation Infrastructure Priorities Work Group, CTIP. And it is a broad group of folks represented there, and to specifically talk about how are we going to pare out those needs that we have, how are we going to prioritize those needs, and how are we going to potentially explore funding those needs in a pay-as-you-go process. Those meetings have been kicked off. The outlook is the projected product of that working group is to come up with recommendations to the governor at the fall of this year so that they can be taken into consideration for the following year's budget to see what opportunities exist for paying for transportation. The challenge is coming up with different ideas to fund needed transportation investments on a pay-as-you-go basis. We have gotten a lot of work done over the last 5 years from one-time infusions, and they are not long-term solutions. And raising the gas tax is only an example. There are many different options, and I think that's exactly what that CTIP group is talking about, is what are our priorities, maintenance, safety, and all the different needs. The only other thing that I would like to talk about is when we look at transportation investments, I think we have to take three things into account. We have to invest in the highest priority work. We have to manage the demand on the transportation system such that we are moving forward in a wise way, and I think California has taken significant steps through legislation, specifically SB 375, and being wise as to how we grow as a state such that it can be managed in a transportation system. And then where we do need to be doing expansion, strategically address the expansion needs, not only on highways and bridges, but in transit as well. So with that, I look forward to answering any of the questions that the audience may have, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And wrapping up for this part of the program, Jeff Morales, talking about bringing a new technology, a new service, and effectively a new transportation mode to the state and figuring out how to pay for it.
Thank you, Mort. I also want to thank the Commonwealth Club for the chance to be here. I also want to acknowledge and thank Secretary Mineta for his work at the Institute and all of his prior work. I think as we talk about the struggles of figuring out how to get things done as we go forward, we'd be well served in looking back at how things used to get done when Secretary Mineta was Chairman Mineta and knew how to get things done in Congress. And there's some lessons there, and I think we would be well served to look back at history and apply those lessons. I also want to thank the audience for the positive questions on high-speed rail in the first session. Often the crowds I'm in are not asking friendly questions, so it's always good to have an audience of enlightened people. The economics of high-speed rail are different than much of other transportation, and certainly what many of the panelists have talked about. And that does bring with it different opportunities, and we certainly are going to do everything we can to make sure that we take advantage of those opportunities. I'll talk about those in a minute, but before doing that, I do want to stress that I think even though we have the ability to tap into different sources of funding, importantly including private sector investment, the ability to do so starts from the same premise as any investment in infrastructure, which is an understanding of the public and the political bodies of the importance of making those investments and a willingness to make those investments. I think we run the risk a little bit of putting the cart before the horse of talking too much about how to develop a consensus on what the source of funding might be when we haven't developed a consensus on the need for investment. And I think that's a mistake those of us in transportation sometimes make. We all get it. We know we need to invest in infrastructure and in transportation, and we probably don't take enough time understanding why it is some of the others in the public aren't getting it as well and why the political bodies aren't getting it. History shows that once we develop as a country or as a region or as local governments, once we develop consensus on the need, we can reach consensus on the means of achieving that. That goes back throughout our history. And I think decisions, it's looking back 50, 100, 150 years, we don't appreciate, since we weren't there, how difficult decisions were. I don't think they were any easier then. They're just look easier with the passage of time. But consensus on the need to link the country and expand into the West through the Transcontinental Railroad. In the 50s, Eisenhower getting the consensus around starting the interstate system. In aviation, something Secretary Mineta was very involved in, creating a whole new source of funding with passenger facility charges, came out of a clear understanding of the importance of doing that, and the means then became apparent. Malcolm talked about things we do here in California with the imposition of dedicated sales taxes. That's clearly tied to an understanding, a very strong understanding of the public of why those taxes are needed and how they're going to be used. The same with bond funds here in California. We have a history of stepping up to the plate that I would suggest no other state has done. And we do that when we make the case of the importance for it. So I think the challenge in front of us is really how do we broaden the argument? How do we make the compelling case of the importance of investing in our transportation infrastructure. And I think Asha's survey pointed out some of that, that as you create a link between money and an outcome, you start to see people nodding and saying, yes, let's go forward. And again, money is there. We're still a very, very wealthy country. We have a huge economy here in California. We have a $1 trillion economy. And, you know, we see Congress, even in this environment, the Senate recently passed a $1 trillion farm bill. Somebody made the case for why that was necessary, and they figured out that there's money there. The money is there. We have to make the case. And so I would argue that the lack of consensus nationally on a source of funding is really a lack of consensus on the need for funding, and we have to attack that first before we can really get to the sources and link those to outcomes. Mort talked about the fact that we are still growing, and that's certainly true here in California, and it's part of the reason, frankly, that high-speed rail is moving forward. What a lot of people lose sight of is that today, one out of every eight Americans is a Californian, which is a pretty amazing statistic when you think about it. And over the next few decades, we are projected, even under some more pessimistic growth projections, we're projected to add the equivalent of the state of New York to California. I always point out that we're not actually bringing actual New Yorkers into California, just the equivalent population. Sorry, Mark. But, so, again, there's a need to do something. Simply maintaining will not be enough. We have to invest in new means of transportation and new ways of connecting people, connecting economies, helping this state grow and prosper. And that's where our program fits into the puzzle as part of it. And we see around the world, 24 countries are making massive investments in high-speed rail. We're doing it not just because they are, but because the underlying reasons are the same. When you look at environmental issues, population growth, other issues, it has to be part of our puzzle in the future. And we can reasonably look, and in fact, all of our plans are based on a combination of federal funding. We have the first piece of that. State funding, local funding, and private sector funding. And in the case of high-speed rail, again, we can realistically look at significant private sector investment, but we have to be very careful to understand how, when, and where that investment can be made and by whom and under what circumstances. Bottom line is the public sector has to drive the agenda. Public sector has to set priorities, set the policies, and provide the stability in the market to allow for the private sector investment. The private sector cannot and will not replace government in this process. It becomes a partner with the government, but it can play a major role. And in our case, we're talking about the very real opportunity for investments of $12 billion of private sector funds in our initial operating system. That investment will be based on the revenues that will be generated out of the system, development opportunities that will be there, and other areas that will attract private funds. But we need the public commitment there first in order to attract that. There needs to be clear stability, and that means an ongoing commitment to the program. We also have to recognize that in the desire to get that private sector investment, we can't get greedy or try to bring it in too early. If you go after private sector money too early, basically you discount it too greatly and we lose the power of it. On the other end, if we wait too long, we lose an opportunity. So it's really finding the sweet spot of how to attract that private investment at the right time for the right purposes. I'm fully confident in all of our very detailed reviews, which have been scoured by any number of external parties, including, very importantly, the U.S. General Accountability Office did a year-long review of our work and basically gave us a clean bill of health. From an accounting perspective, it was about as close to a bear hug as you can get. they gave us no recommendations of anything to do differently. And they said that, yes, all of our projections are reasonable, what our plan is reasonable, what we're talking about makes sense. We will get private sector funding in our program. I think that will show how it can be done not just here in California, but elsewhere around the country. But again, I'll just close by saying, even in a system where we can get a third or more of our funding from the private sector, it has to start with a public sector commitment to the program and to getting it done, and an understanding of the importance of investing in a system like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. We have a large wealth of questions here. We're obviously not going to be able to get to all of them, but I'll try to collapse them in one way or another. But I'll open up with one question for each of our panelists that represents a little bit of a softball. Asha, wanted to ask you about what your findings were in the survey about people's sophisticated ability to look at trade-offs in making these decisions. Everything isn't yes, no, but how are they open to trade-offs?
I'm afraid we really just didn't design a survey that would test for that. So, sorry, don't know.
Okay. Flora, what's the future of public transit in this country? Are you positive about it? Somebody asked this, and I just pass it along.
I have to tell you, I'm very excited about it, the whole industry as a whole. If Michael Malanoff, our CEO, would be here, he would tell you the same thing. You know, we continue to see the demands on ridership, and we, when we look at the value that we're providing back to the local communities, we're very excited about it. From, you know, as a policymaker from New Jersey Transit, I see what it does to the regional economies of New York and New Jersey. And so from that perspective, I'm even more encouraged about the future of it.
Thank you, Flora. And Malcolm, I've got one for you before we get to some tough questions. Someone, I think one of your staff, wants to know what's been the biggest success that Caltrans has achieved over the last 20 years that you've been here.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily a success of mine, but I'm going to go back to the successful delivery of the Proposition 1B program. That was passed in 2006, and a lot of the projects were selected in 2007. And there were commitments made on a specific list of projects, major projects, to be delivered and awarded to contracts by the end of 2012. And not only did we meet that delivery, we had savings in the projects that we turned around and recycled those into additional projects. So we over-delivered that mega program and delivered projects in a five-year period. One example is the Corridor Mobility Improvement Account, which was a $4.5 billion program, and we ended up with the value of the program when we had other fund sources put to it was in excess of $7 billion, and I think we had $1 billion worth of savings, and we recycled that into additional projects. So to be able to turn around those types of projects that had significant improvements to the transportation system in a five-year period is very impressive. And that, it was not done by Caltrans alone. Our local partners played a big role, and it was public and private that ended up delivering that program. But I think that that is a huge success. And I think as we talk about additional revenue for infrastructure and transportation, we have to highlight when we did get additional investment that we made good use of it. So therefore, that additional investment will produce good benefits in the future to the people of California.
That's the kind of story we have to tell if we're going to ask people for money. Jeff, when will high-speed rail be finished?
How's that for a softball?
Yeah, there you go. Well, let me, pivot. As someone who's operated in the political environment, let me deflect that question for a second. You can't talk about high-speed rail, certainly here in California or in the country, without talking about Rod Dearden and the work he did to really get this program going. And I think we, you know, anyone who believes in high-speed rail should thank Rod for all the work that he's done over the years to get us to where we are. And I thank you. The exciting thing about where we are is the last year we have made an amazing amount of progress building on literally years of planning and steps that were taken leading up to this stage. Last summer, almost a year ago, it'll be a year ago in a few weeks, the state legislature took what was truly an historic vote to invest not just in high-speed rail but in a really revolutionary statewide rail modernization program. The legislature appropriated almost $4.7 billion, which we then are leveraging with state and federal, local and federal monies to actually generate over $13 billion worth of investments in rail in California. And that's everything from local transit, including here in the Bay Area, and new cars. Very importantly, the Caltrain electrification project, which will actually be the first taste of electrified high-speed rail in the state. That is getting going because of the program that we got started last year. That will be up and running in 2019. And we are beginning this summer the construction of the nation's first true high-speed rail system in the Central Valley. And we have a 5-year construction period for our initial segment, and we'll be there.
All right, now for some hard questions. And I'll start with Malcolm. I've got several questions here. They happen to be specific projects, but rather than deal with those, kind of the generic. The world is changing. People actually seem to be driving less. Fewer people are getting driving licenses. Are you looking at the long-term demand and what the factors ought to be for planning the system for the future?
Well, I think that's a very informed question, because it's an entire transportation system that we need to be looking at, between rail, between the highways and alternative modes. They've all got to work together. The entire transportation system needs to be integrated and connected. And I think as a state, we need to provide a leadership along those lines. There certainly is a lot of decision-making, and appropriately so, is done at the local level as far as land use and likewise. But the state definitely wants to take a leadership role in how we work with our local partners and integrate all those decisions and how it impacts and affects the transportation system, and making sure that it's connected. The highway system is connected to, you know, the metropolitan areas and the concentration of employment. It's connected to transit. It's making availability and clean connections to the future high-speed train. And all of that in the movement of people is playing nicely with the movement of goods within California and through California. So I think that is absolutely a focus for the department. We've done interregional blueprint planning as well as blueprint planning at the local level, and I think that's an important step from a planning standpoint.
And one for Jeff. As you're looking at the future development of the system, what are the opportunities for joint development, for land use investments, and do those have potential for being part of the funding source for the system?
No question. And that starts right here in San Francisco at the Transbay Terminal, which has incredible opportunities to really shape what parts of the city look like and to become a model for how development can be used to help promote infrastructure and vice versa. We are looking at and increasingly working with cities to look at how we really develop our program in conjunction with how they're developing their cities. It's interesting to note that one of the strongest proponents of the program is Ashley Swearingen, the mayor of Fresno, who, you know, just says the best tool to combat urban sprawl in Fresno, in the Fresno region, is sound development with high-speed rail as a centerpiece of it. It's interesting to note that in the Central Valley, where we will be through our construction impacting less than 5,000 acres of farmland, over 120,000 acres of farmland have been lost to development in the last 8 years. I mean, so we have to look at how we develop this state more soundly, how we can use the advent of high-speed rail and stations and all of the connecting services to them as a way to really focus development. We're working with cities. We're providing planning grants to cities to help them develop that in conjunction with us. And we're talking to the private sector about what the role they can play in it, in developing stations and developing parts of our infrastructure as well.
Thank you. And let me go back to Malcolm and ask a question about bicycle and pedestrian. Question asks, can we be more like Amsterdam or New York, or I'd add Washington, in building specific cycle tracks? I also would draw people's attention to the awesome picture in this morning's New York Times of 30,000 bicycles parked outside the main railway station in Amsterdam. I don't know how you find yours at the end of the day. Yeah, bike and ped.
You know, I just in the last couple of days, I saw an article, and I'm not even sure what publication it was in, and it was talking about, it was actually an electronic, so it was on the internet somewhere, talking about the top 20 bicycle-friendly cities in the world. And disappointingly, none of them were in the United States. Mm-hmm. I thought Davis was going to be in there, but it must not be a big enough city to make the list. But Amsterdam and some of those other cities were well represented on the list. And I think the challenge that we have in the United States is to make our transportation system more bike-friendly, make the entire network really assist and accommodate that mode of transportation. On the state side, I find it, I have a dilemma in that locals want to make certain decisions on bike and ped circulation, and they're not all consistent. So we want to make sure when we're working with our local partners that we're not an impediment. If anything, we can be an encourager and supporter and pusher, possibly. But it's difficult for us to implement statewide standards because they don't fit every city's desire to develop a bike and ped. So again, I think we want to try to provide a leadership role and work very closely with our local partners for them to develop bike and ped facilities that really meet the needs of their city and us not be an impediment to that that venture.
Thank you. Let me throw out a question for each of the panelists if you want to respond to it. How can we do a better job of advocacy? We don't see the people out there holding the signs saying we need to improve our transportation system. Are we just lying down on the job and not bringing this to people's attention? What's the relationship to the elected officials, even at the national level? Are there trade-offs that we should be developing? The question here, for example, about using more of the defense budget, less money for that, more money for transit. That essentially, by the way, is what the president had proposed in drawing down our military obligations. Transfer some of that to domestic investment. But the debate goes on, but we don't get closer to an answer. Is there something wrong with our advocacy? And I'll open it up to anybody who wants to.
I would just say that sometimes I think that some of our customers take us for granted, and so I would encourage us to press the flesh to make sure that at any point in time you're communicating with those individuals in Congress and our state legislatures, because it does matter. You know, when you think about what Congress has to deal with, you heard about the farm bill, you know, the gun bill. They have so many different bills and so many different constituents that come their way that we ourselves have to make the ones that put transportation front and center in front of our elected officials. It is critical. And, you know, now we have a whole multitude of our riders, the ones that more referred to, those that are not getting licenses. We ought to be able to engage them. We ought to be able to activate them to help tell our stories, connect them to the value that Asha talked about, the local value, and how we as transit professionals are being accountable to their taxpayer dollars, and then the return on investment that is created to the communities, where there is all that return on investment with the joint developments. I think it's important for us to encourage and activate all of us to continue to tell that story. Make it local, make that connection.
If I might add a few thoughts, I thought that Jeff very aptly summed up our funding problem when he said, well, part of it is really just a problem that we haven't agreed that we need more money.
I've got a question here that says, do we really know we need more money?
But I would argue, and it's actually a very good question, that I don't think we have a compelling vision that we share with the general public or our elected officials. We often focus on individual projects, and that's good, and those can be exciting, but we focus a lot on the problems, bridges falling down, potholes, and while nobody likes them, I don't think it's a really exciting sell. I think we need to do a much better job of painting, you know, it's not reaching the moon, but something tangible and exciting that we sell people as this is where we can get as either a local community or a national society if we come together and you know then agree on how we get there and what the individual steps and funding packages are. And I don't think that we even try to do that very much as a transportation community. And if we don't do it, certainly who is going to?
Well, certainly one who seems to struggle in getting the good news out, I'll chime in. Everybody expects that the transportation system is always going to be there and there's never going to be a problem with it. And I don't get a phone call when they get to work when they expected to get to work. I get a phone call when they didn't get to work when they expected to get to work. And I think it goes back to translating that to the general public as to what the value of a efficient transportation system is. And to me, it's an economic value and it's a quality of life value. And the reliability of that transportation system, whether or not it's the highway system or a transit system, is very important to people. And I think that's what we're really selling. We're selling a service, access, and reliability. And we have to tell the good news. We have to portray that that's what we're accomplishing when we invest it. There are significant accomplishments in the transportation region throughout the state, but you're not necessarily reading about those. And I think the onus is on us as transportation officials to try to get that good news out and translate that into the benefits that the general public are receiving from that transportation investment.
Yeah, Mort, I would point to two things. One, I think, as was mentioned, the lack of a vision or a driving purpose. And I think if you look back nationally, for 50 years, Congress passed recurring reauthorization bills investing. And there was a common thread throughout all those, which was building the interstate system. That's what started it. And every few years, whatever cycle Congress was on, that was a common piece. We have to continue the program to finish the interstate program. Well, we're basically done with the interstate program, and I don't think it's a coincidence that once that was substantially done, the will in Congress kind of dried up to really take this on and do it the way it used to. So we have to find a way to replace that common sense of purpose that did, in fact, unify the country about the need to invest, and that included raising revenues when necessary. One other piece, and I think it goes back again to how we connect with people and sell the message, is really turning the discussion away from spending to investment. You know, that what we're talking about are investments, and there's a return on those investments. Maybe not a return in the traditional sense people might think of in private sector, but there's an economic return. You know, we face that battle with people talking about, you know, and Malcolm talked about the 1B program. There, you know, people on one side of the argument just want to talk about the debt service associated with issuing bonds. They don't look at the fact that, for instance, in our program, we're going to be building and starting construction and employing thousands of people in the Central Valley where unemployment is 15%. And unemployment in the construction industry is over 20%. So that, yeah, we're paying debt service on one side, but we're taking people off of unemployment. We're putting them back in the marketplace where they're now contributing back into society, into the tax rolls and things. And we don't really have a good way of capturing that consistently and selling that investment and the return on it.
Thank you, Jeff. Malcolm, in this room full of Bay Area folks, I have to give you an opportunity to comment on the Bay Bridge. We're going out to visit it this afternoon, so I'll ask, is it safe?
Well, I actually appreciate the opportunity to talk about it briefly to what I would consider an informed audience. We won't open it until it's safe, I can guarantee you that. Certainly, back in March, when we had the failure of 32 bolts, it was not an expected occurrence. And it gave us one last challenge, hopefully one last challenge to overcome before we open up the bridge. Today, sitting here, I can't tell you whether or not we're going to be able to open on the scheduled date of Labor Day because we are continuing to evaluate the schedule for the retrofit of those 32 bolts as well as completing the complete evaluation and thorough testing of all the other bolts. There are a million bolts on the bridge. There are 2,300 that fit into the specifications of the 32 bolts that broke. The 32 bolts that broke all came in one heat or one batch back in 2008. Now, unfortunately, they happened to be in a location where they were embedded in concrete, so they couldn't just be replaced. So that's the added the complexity of a retrofit. But again, the other 2,300 bolts that are specified the same way are all performing. We're not relying on that piece of data. We're going back and testing them all and evaluating them to figure out what the long-term disposition of those bolts are, and we won't open up the bridge until we fully have the confidence that those bolts are going to serve the purpose. All of those bolts are going to serve the purpose that they are intended to serve. We are not looking at day one. We are looking at decades from now and making sure that whatever decisions we make today are going to serve the purpose of that bridge. AASHTO requirements, national standards for a bridge like that, is a 75-year life. That bridge is designed for a 150-year life. It also far exceeds the design criteria for seismic safety. That bridge is supposed to be open back up to service immediately after a large earthquake. Normally, success is driven by it not falling down, a bridge not falling down. This bridge needs to be a lifeline bridge. It needs to be in service very quickly after an earthquake such that it gets supplies and equipment to needed places. So it is designed at a very high level. We experienced an unexpected problem with one batch of bolts, and now we're evaluating all the other bolts to ensure that they're going to be safe. And we won't open it up until we know that that's going to be the case. And we've put a marker out there to brief the Bay Area Toll Authority on July 10th because we think we'll have enough information at that time to be able to share with the public that we have a confidence level that we can open on this date or we cannot open on that date. And safety will be the driving factor as to when we can open it up.
Thank you. Flora, and this is more from your New Jersey Transit perspective. How do we convey to the public with respect to our transit systems that they are operating efficiently, that we're recovering what we can from the fare box, and that this isn't money that we're just paying out without getting benefit for it?
I think, again, we're able to do that by demonstrating the value that it brings to the communities. When you think about many of the projects within New Jersey, I'd like to highlight what the Hudson Bergen Light Rail has done for that community. Prior to the light rail being built, there was vacant buildings. The infrastructure was not there. And what you have now is that you have companies jumping at the bit to make sure that they can relocate their corporate headquarters there. So using those examples more to show the communities, our riders, our taxpayers, that yes, we're maximizing whatever taxpayer dollars we invest back in those systems is probably the best way for us to continue to show that.
Thank you. Jeff, I've got a couple of questions about the interface between your system and the rest of the state transportation system, the local, regional ones. How are you going about making that a successful integration, and are there opportunities perhaps for innovative ways to bring these systems together?
Short answer, yes. We're working very closely, and it's been one of the biggest pushes we've made, especially over the last year or so, to really make sure that we're working closely with regional and local partners. And I have to say, Malcolm and I, as heads of our respective agencies, are working very closely together to prioritize things. And the governor proposed and the legislature approved a consolidation of transportation agencies. Now, which I think will have really help promote this whole idea of investing and making sure that we're working together. We are making investments jointly with local agencies. Maybe the most dramatic example is here on the peninsula with Caltrain. The old plans called for a fully dedicated, separate high-speed rail infrastructure up and down the peninsula. That had some controversy attached to it, and we worked with Caltrain and determined that we could achieve our outcomes by upgrading the existing infrastructure and investing in it. That translated into not only a system that will be able to come online much sooner, but also save something on the order of $12 to $15 billion of investment by being able to do that. So that's the type of thing we're certainly looking to do all over the state. For our system to function, most of it has to be dedicated. You just can't run 200 miles an hour on another track. But where we can share infrastructure, we will, and where we can make investments that provide mutual benefits, we absolutely will.
Thank you. And I'm getting a message to wrap up here, so I'm just going to put out one more question for each of you to please respond to. As we look at what the opportunities are for future funding, and there are, we know there are many, gas tax increases, vehicle mile fees, registration fees, development opportunities. Without using the word all of the above, can you at least tell us what you think the criteria should be for making those decisions? And if you happen to know what the right decision is, let us know now. And I'll start with Asha.
Well, I would say that when we're deciding which opportunities we want to pursue, that we really need to think about what are going to be the sort of secondary or maybe not initially anticipated impacts. So, for example, and there are some options that will help us manage our transportation system better or achieve other national policy objectives. So, for example, if you use general fund revenues or sales taxes to fund transportation, and there are benefits to those, you don't send any incentives to drivers, to passengers, to use the system in an efficient way. By contrast, high enough gas taxes make fuel more expensive and encourage people to, say, buy more fuel-efficient cars, which can help reduce some of our global warming, air pollution, and other environmental issues. Similarly, congestion pricing, while not very popular with a lot of people, has the quite amazing side effect that it provides congestion-free alternatives for some drivers, and so helps us manage our system effectively at the same time as potentially raising revenue. So I think we really want to try and think about these system benefits that we can get from different transportation funding and options, in addition to does it raise money, is it politically acceptable, and those important questions.
I would just, you know, without saying all of the above, I'll say that obviously there's no one single model there. However, looking at the past feedback from the taxpayers and all the measures that have passed, there's a variety of different options that local communities are entertaining. So while that is something that we ought to look at, when you look at a lot of people are accepting sales tax increases, property tax increases, bonding, vehicle fees, and others. So, I guess we have a plethora of whatever works for the community, as long as we're and telling the story and how we're, holding each other accountable to their taxpayer dollars.
Malcolm? Okay, I certainly am not allowed to advocate one over another, I will offer up comments on some of the different things that are being discussed. I do not believe that it'll be one solution. I think it'll be a list of solutions that address different needs across the board. I think it will ultimately have to be more of a user fee. What are you paying and how are you paying for how much you are using the transportation system, which would lend itself to somewhat of a mileage-based system in the long run, but that is difficult to switch over to. The gas tax is the easiest, only because it has the existing mechanisms in place. So it was mentioned earlier today that several other states have moved and already increased the gas tax. I don't think that that's a long-term solution. Again, we're hooking our wagon to something that is, going away or decreasing, but it is the mechanism that exists. Tolling and public-private partnerships will play some role, but it will not be the solution. And again, I'm going to, punt and take the easy way out and say that it's going to be a collection of solutions.
It's kind of like saying all the above.
That's right. You like that, huh?
Right. Yeah, I think we've seen or are seeing two shifts that are, if not permanent, certainly long term. And Malcolm just touched certainly on one, which is moving away from being reliant on a single source or a single primary source of funding. I think as we go forward, whatever the solution is, it's going to be a combination of things. Another, from the federal perspective, I think, is that we're seeing and will continue to see a shift away from traditional grant making to a stronger emphasis on financing and leveraging funds as opposed to providing direct outright grants. I would advocate, and I obviously do this from the perspective of California and what California has been willing to do, but I think we should be advocating a national program that rewards those who help themselves and encourages others and provides incentives to step up to the plate, and so that funding is provided with a priority to those who are stepping up to the plate themselves and helping make every dollar stretch further.
Thank you, and we'll thank all our panelists. To remind our radio audience, the panelists were Dr. Asha Weinstein-Agrawal, director of the Mineta Transportation Institute National Transportation Finance Center, Flora Castillo, chair of the American Public Transportation Association, Malcolm Doherty, director of the California Department of Transportation, and Jeff Morales, chief executive officer of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. We also again want to thank Catherine Thompson, the Acting General Counsel for USDOT, and former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Norm Mineta for their participation in the earlier part of this session. The program today has been co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute and held in association with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, the American Public Transportation Association, and the Bay Area Metropolitan Transportation Commission. And we certainly want to thank the Commonwealth Club for putting this together, giving us this opportunity to talk among ourselves and with you, and also our audience here on the radio, on television, and on the Internet. I'm Mort Downey, former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation, and I will call this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California to adjournment.